Hey, hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
And I'm Jess DeBeer, Associate Director and Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, today our guest is joining us all the way from Switzerland. He is Chief Investment Officer for UBS Global Wealth Management, Mr. Mark Haefeli.
Wow. Considering what's going on today, I'm sure he's got a lot to tell us. I'm looking forward to see who's stopping by.
I have my landscaper people here. Son of a mother. They were supposed to come later, and they're here now. They're going to be like blowing the deck right when Mark comes on, I have no doubt.
Oh, I'm very excited. He's an interesting cat, man. The topics that are pretty interesting about him is like he has this whole chapter basically on know thyself, know who you are. And he talks about kind of his relationship with money, which is interesting to me because his grandparents were a big part of his life. They grew up really poor, and then it was handed down to his dad and some of the way his dad talked about things. So he feels like he has this DNA where he has like this scarcity mindset. And it wasn't until. Yeah.
I have a question. If you saw a catalog of books starting with the words, the new rule, what book would you be like, oh, I need to know the new rules on that?
You're saying they all have the name, they all have the title of the new rule?
Yeah. What new rule of blank would you gravitate toward first?
I like things that are against conventional wisdom. So if it says the new rules of something we commonly understand, I'm a big believer, and the more and more we've seen this, is general consensus is wrong. All these fancy charts and facts and figures, you can boil them all down is like you want to be a contrarian. Because that's where you can stand to make the most gains. And so the general consensus, if you just push against the general consensus, that's generally not a bad principle. We just don't realize it at the time. It isn't until like retrospect. So
we're just all a bunch of followers.
It's easier. It's harder.
It is easier.
It's harder to go against the crowd. And I think that's what I would gravitate to. Like, so that's why the new something, if it is an affront to what we have generally accepted, I'm like, there's something to that.
Okay. All right. Let's do it.
Okay, listeners. Today, we're going to be talking to a very important person at UBS. You should know he's a bit of an influencer of sorts. Jess, I'm not talking about the kind of that shows up on your TikTok feed. You won't see him at Coachella or lip syncing to Taylor Swift
songs.
Because
that's the only thing that's on my feed.
That's the only thing that's on there.
Okie dokie.
From a nondescript office in Zurich, Switzerland, he oversees the investment process for one of the largest pools of private capital in the world. Mark Haefeli is the UBS Global Wealth Management Chief Investment Officer. Under his leadership, our Chief Investment Officer has been twice named Best Private Bank by an industry publication. And in 2004, UBS was recognized by Euromoney as the world best bank. Before counseling some of the wealthiest families in the world at UBS, he's had a very interesting life. A former lecturer and acting dean at Harvard University, Mark graduated summa cum laude from Princeton University, earned both master's and a PhD from Harvard, and as a Fulbright scholarship, he obtained a master's degree from the Australian National University. He started his first hedge fund from his college dorm room. After a lot of success, he retired at the ripe age of 36. He emerged from his retirement in 2011 to help UBS after the great financial crisis. He authored the recently released book, The New Rules of Investing, Wealth Strategies for Our Turbulent Times, offering a playbook for protecting and growing wealth in today's dynamic financial landscape. You've seen Mark as a guest on CNBC and Bloomberg. He's been featured in the vaunted Wall Street Journal. Today, he graces yet another respected broadcast. Mark Haefeli, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Doug. That was very fun. Yeah.
Thanks for stopping by. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the book. The New Rules of Investing. Love the book. I feel like anytime you see the new rules of anything, you're going to be drawn to it. So tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write the book and how do you define these new rules compared to conventional wisdom?
Sure. So I think there were a couple of things. First, during COVID, I saw this chart and it showed the U.S. government expenditure as a percentage of overall GDP in the United States reached the same levels as during World War II. And I thought, well, was World War II maybe a time to rethink your investment strategy? And then I was thinking kind of, well, what have I learned in the past 30 years of doing this? And I think there were three things that I hit on. Basically, like, I'm not Warren Buffett. You're not Warren Buffett. We have to deal with that. Part of it is value investing and how that has changed. The second part is in this second career after being a hedge fund manager, working with clients around the world at UBS, kind of what have I learned about helping them? And then the third part is what have they helped me with in understanding kind of the directions that investing is going in the future? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to take all that and put it together in a book.
I want to get into the rules here, but one of the things that came up in sort of reading this, essentially, you've been raised in this world and learned to pivot. And the thing you talk about is adaptability. And so in working with clients, we understand that the words mean different things to different people, right? Most of the time, you can't time the market. And clients will tell you, I understand that. I'm not trying to time the market. So how can investors balance being flexible, but still stay disciplined to their long-term strategy?
Look, I think a lot of the book is about knowing yourself. And there's a lot of humiliating stories in the book about me trying to know myself. And try to open that space up to talk about it. To your point, everybody says they're Chuck Norris and they're super tough. And then something happens and they're not. Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And the market rolling over on you can really feel like a punch in the face. So there's a number of strategies that I think we've developed at UBS that I've learned to be particularly effective in practice working with clients. The first is the UBS Wealth Way, the three L's, liquidity, longevity, and legacy. This is super important. Basically, with this strategy, say, what do I need to sleep at night? What is it, 3 to 5 years of paying my bills, whatever that number is, that's a bucket. And that's a serious bucket that you take seriously. The longevity bucket is what do I need over my lifetime? Legacy bucket is what do I need beyond my lifetime? Or the way an advisor can ask it is, how can I help you today? How can I help you tomorrow? And how can I help you help others? And with that framework, you know, when the market sells off, you're not fearful, you're actually excited because you're like, ha, I have my money put away. Now I can approach this sell-off with a mindset of abundance and take advantage of it. And it makes a huge shift. The other thing is core and satellite, like knowing that I'm gonna go to a cocktail party and somebody's gonna talk about a hot stock and I'm not gonna be able to hold myself back because that's just who I am as a person. So have a small portfolio where you do your trading and things. Size it right so that it doesn't upset your entire plan and deal with these things ahead of time.
Mark, the title, The New Rules for Investing, comes off a very high level. But the reality is, as you read through the book, it's very relatable concept, very simple principles, and it's about people and human behavior. I mean, it's not what you expect when you talk to somebody that's impressively in charge of trillions of dollars of wealth. The simple, approachable tools are like, yeah, I mean, this is something we deal with all the time. So along those lines of adaptability, you have come to kind of change and shape the way you thought about investing and asset allocating. Can you give me an example of maybe an investor or institution that's also been able to do this, actually adapt and evolve with the changing times?
Well, look, I mean, I have to tell a little bit about UBS adapting, right? Because before the financial crisis, UBS, the business model was not necessarily based on being a world-class investor. And I think to its credit, after the financial crisis, UBS realized, said, hey, we can't just be good about putting money behind the Swiss Alps. The world is open and we have to be a good investor. And, you know, it was a really unique window
where they looked around and they're willing to hire me to work on the investment side. So I got very lucky at that point. That adaptability, there was a crisis that made it pivot, but there's other companies that didn't pivot. That's, you know, one example.
It was an eye-opener for me. I always refer to the great financial crisis. I was just getting started in my career. I started in 2006. Market was up. Market was up again in 2007 for the most part. And then 2008 was like a learning. And it was everything is sort of through that lens. And so do you think that's kind of that's been really the biggest shift? It was kind of before the great financial crisis and then the world after the great financial crisis. Do you look at it that way?
The financial crisis was a massive change in our system because getting a little historical here and a little nerdy about it for over 100 years.
We love nerdy. Okay. Just
all right.
For the record.
Go to our listeners. So, they love it.
Okay. All right. So look, for over 100 years, right or wrong, I'm not making a political argument here. The Democratic Party had not necessarily an ambivalent relationship with capitalism, but you know, there were during the financial crisis, there were those say on the left saying, we've got to nationalize the banks, where this is a chance to really change things and fix things. The Obama administration and Tim Geithner, they said, we're actually going to take government money and buy equity in the banks. We're going to buy stocks. Yeah. And that was kind of a massive shift in mindset on how we're going to do things and reaffirmation of capitalism in a way. But it was also accompanied by the Federal Reserve launching QE and really saying, we are going to take the steps so that we really get out of this because we have to pull out of this. And so I think that was a big shift. And of course, if you look at, say, the past, 6 years or so, where you had massive fiscal stimulus going into the economy during COVID, and then you had the massive monetary stimulus of this Fed balance sheet and the Fed buying of assets, that is a fundamental change. And we know that it's completely distorted markets to the point where we got to negative interest rates in Europe, which we didn't even know could exist.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned humbling experiences a little bit earlier. And in the book, in the chapter titled Understanding That Investing is an Exercise in Humility, you share some personal stories that have shaped your investment philosophy, including your experiences as a paratrooper and climbing the highest, tallest mountain in the United States. So tell us, how have these experiences influenced your approach to risk and investment decisions? Paratrooper, come on.
The real correct term for what I did is I'm a five-jump chump, as they say, because I successfully completed U.S. Army basic parachute course. There's a couple of things I'm trying to say. The first is that in both those things, my male testosterone poisoning or appetite for risk almost got me killed. And then there's other times in markets, trading a hedge fund was a near-death experience. I hate that feeling, and I don't ever want to feel that way again, but I know that those tough times will come again. And so it's really about having the humility to realize, like, hoping that I'm not going to fail or pretending it won't happen to me, there's no chance of that. It's really just setting up systems, thinking ahead, so I don't end up in those situations ever again, and really just having like a visceral hatred of too much risk. Maybe you just learn that over time. Maybe that's what wisdom is. But I thought it was important to put that into the book, that you've got to, you know, hope is not an investment strategy is another way of saying it.
So you mentioned in the book the five D's: debt, deglobalization, decarbonization, digitalization, and demographics. And you look at them as structural changes affecting investments. How do you think those themes translate for investors and sort of how you look at the world?
As the world has changed and think more about government intervention, we've tried to put that in a framework that's different than, say, just the sectors of the S&P 500 or something like that. And then also, too, especially after Ukraine, here in Europe, where it's not that far away, we're getting clients in who are just so even physically fearful. How do you frame the world and all that's going on in a way that can kind of reframe it in a way which they're open to thinking about investing, you know, as an opportunity and not just being fearful? And we kind of hit on the five D's. It's an extension of this idea that we're not fully in free markets, that you want to buy what the government is buying. And that, what is the government buying? Well, the government, driven by politics, is focused on the big problems, and they're throwing big money at the big problems. Of the five D's, we would focus on the greatest opportunities probably are in the decarbonization, the demographics, and the digitalization, meaning the electric grid, then AI, and then demographics is really around healthcare and the aging populations that need more and more drugs and healthcare. So if you think about, okay, well, AI, well, to get the AI, you need the power or the data center. Okay, what does that look like? That could be a real estate play. That could be a copper play. That could be a stock play. But really thinking about it in terms of value chains rather than just stock market sectors, that was a change in our thinking. And trying to get domain expertise and the teams to be experts in these value chains, that's one of the changes that we made. And then the other one is, we're having this discussion today because the 30 year is creeping up towards 5% in the United States around debt. You know, in the book, I talk about kind of a slightly different view of things. Many people, at least in Europe, think where it's like, well, you know, the debt is going up and the bond vigilantes will come in and fix that. And it's like, well, they may, but you also have this government intervention. And I think we think the yields are somewhat capped because the Fed is not going to let bond yields get too high because they can't, the U.S. can't roll over its debt, right? The level of debt is becoming existential for the United States. And if you borrow $100 from the bank, it's your problem. $33 trillion, that's the bank's problem. And I think the U.S., we see the U.S. trying to take its problems and socialize them to the rest of the world. That could be a destabilizing factor. It could have an impact on the dollar. It probably means in the short term, 30-year rates are not spiking to 8% and staying there. So when you start thinking about the world differently, is not just about free markets, it changes the way you think about some of these trades.
So you talk about following the money, government spending, that you said that chart you looked at the beginning. So how can as regular people follow the money in that context?
Yeah, well, I think in a democracy, people say what they're doing. So take something like the Inflation Reduction Act, just as an example. What they were going to do in that was announced and it was published and it was voted on. Money was and we're going to send the money out, right? And even if you waited for until all those things happened and then bet on the infrastructure index, it still went up a lot in the next year, right? So it's not that hard in a democracy to actually see what the government is spending its money on. So we mentioned AI. What happened yesterday? Saudi Arabia bought a bunch of chips trying to buy a bunch of chips, right? And the semiconductor index, defense spending is another topic. Defense is hard because there's longer lead times and things, but in general, is European defense spending going down or up? I mean, they have a plan to spend 5% of GDP. That will get extended and things. So, you know, it's something to keep in your mind when the stocks fell off, say, I know what the government's going to be spending its money on here. And so those are simple ways. Now, I talk about that in the first part of the book. If you want to be an active investor, these are the things you now have to think about, because these government trends can overwhelm day-to-day. Some of the work that I used to do on valuation and accounting and things like that, I'd also argue you got to be careful if you're doing this yourself, because you are up against experts who are doing it every day. The most important thing is you focus on that 80% of this asset allocation. And when you get that right, if you want to then spend your time thinking about this 20%, which is the active investing, here's how we approach it. This was really important for me to write about, because when I started in finance, behavioral finance didn't exist at all. And this was, I tell the story in the book, this was brought home to me by talking to Paul Tudor Jones, who's known as like one of the greatest traders in the world. But he described to me how everything he does around a trade, he logs and records what time he gets up, what he had for breakfast, how he's feeling, all these things. This is a guy who's like the greatest trader in the world, and he is taking this so seriously every day. Number one, like recognizing that everybody, the top people, have to deal with this, and you have to deal with it, I have to deal with it, and really getting to know yourself. money's not just about money. So what is it about? And figuring that out, for me, talk about kind of how in my family got getting instilled with a scarcity mindset and how that infected a lot of my decision-making. Being disciplined around an asset allocation is a huge part of this. We talked about 3 L's, that's a huge part of this. And then working with a professional, either as a coach or doing this for you, so that you don't lose a lot of money and ruin your life obsessing about stocks. The real lesson in learning from people all around the world is whatever amount of money they have, they're people, and they have emotions and they have experiences that impact what they do. That is no correlation to wealth.
We're talking about investing, so we have to mention diversification, right? But in today's world, everything seems to sort of be interconnected, particularly found at times in crisis, things kind of trend. Is it harder to diversify now because of the way trends are working, or any tips in that world?
I think depending on the mindset you take to it. Yeah, I mean, there are times, right, where you're seeing stocks and bonds trade together. And I think what has really sent some ripples around the world very recently is that the stock market sold off and the US dollar sold off at the same time. There's no question there are these stories of correlation, but you know, that's not an excuse not to try and find the uncorrelated assets, right? Because there are hedge funds that have provided a lot of diversification. That's been a real tool that people have deployed well in the first quarter of this year, for example. People come to me with this question. I say, well, let's really see what you're doing. Yeah, nothing's perfect, but are you really doing everything you can in diversification? And the answer, of course, is usually, well, no.
I want to circle back. We talked about AI a little bit. Can you talk a little bit more about AI and what role do you think it's going to play in our business? And do you have any other real world examples of using it today?
AI is probably the single greatest trend in our investment process. We're overweight AI in our investment portfolios, and we use it in the CIO office. Our US analysts have an AI analyst to help them go through filings and other things. We use it extensively in first drafts of translations. We also, I recorded this video, and now they have a version of me that can deliver anything in many languages around the world in my voice with natural hand gestures and things like that. People say, when are you going to be replaced by a robot? I say, well, or AI. And it's like, when you look up online what's wrong with you and book a AI surgery and never talk to a doctor, that's when you can let go of talking to a person about your finances, which is can be as serious as your health, right? I mean, you want to use all these tools, but you want to have person giving it a sanity check and a common sense check and a air traffic control approach to things, kind of managing things, right? And making the more emotional sides of the decision. So the AI is huge. And it's not just that we use it. It's that all the clients I talk to around the world are increasingly using AI. And 2 days ago, I talked to a hedge fund manager who grew up in the French kind of university system and was a mathematician. I mean, this guy runs a big hedge fund. And he said for the first time last year, they started hiring more for philosophy graduates than mathematicians. And he said, because before that, if you thought up an idea, you needed the mathematical skills to execute the idea. But now, because AI can execute the idea in the math, really, now they can hire for people who can think up the questions. And that, to me, is a huge shift. I think this is a fascinating trend that is going on.
Let me plug this book, because it really, in reading it, The New Rules of Investing, it's good not just for investors and geeks like me, but it's also good because it's relatable. I mean, I feel like some of these chapters, Mark, this is your therapy. This is you defining to yourself why I do these things, how I'm programmed. I think it's really neat. And especially as you come to say things that are anti-conventional, as would you say, along those lines, what's something that you would say that you feel that maybe 75% of people would disagree?
Markets are amoral. It's not for me to say what I think the world should be like. My job is to just say, right or wrong, this is how we think the world works right now. And so how do I help you apply that to your portfolio? That's hard for some people because they want to say, I think the world should be this way, and I'm going to bet my portfolio that way. But that's like, that's why there's some of these online sports betting companies that make so much money, because people bet on the home team, even if that's, they have no chance of winning. If you do things like that, please get an advisor for your investments.
We hear that all the time. I think it should do this, so I'm going to do that. And it's like, that's not the game.
So let's look at 10 years from now, 10 years ahead. Do you think these rules are still going to hold, or how do you think they might evolve again?
I think the fundamental principles that government intervention is increasingly important to how you think about markets, I think that'll be there. I think buying what the governments are buying will certainly be there. I think the focus on asset allocation and people are people is absolutely going to be there. I think we'll be further along in finding ways of doing well and doing good with our investments. I think we'll have to. I mean, I wrote this book. Nobody who reads it once is going to have all three parts of the book speak to them the same way. But I hope that if they come back to it at a different point, they say, oh yeah, now that I'm 10 years further along, this part speaks to me more than it did then, or something like that, because it is kind of three different parts of my career. But I would just say, as long as people are still people and not replaced by profit maximizing AI machines, the principles are going to still be there.
I have a question. Yeah. I'm going off script because I'm just wondering this. Do you have a go-to karaoke tune, Mark?
I remember one time go to church and this mother called up and was like, oh, would Mark join the church choir? No. Flat out. I was like, I'm never thinking of it. That was a great decision. I'm never rethinking that one.
You also mentioned that in the book, working out is sort of your therapy. What does that mean? Are we pumping iron? Are we running races? What do you do?
I'm on the drug that killed River Phoenix. And that's all. So my wife does a lot of biking and a lot of running. I can't keep up with her, but I do both of those things. I think you got to mix it up with weights, strength training. Yeah. Lately, I've been doing a lot more longer runs and listening to these podcasts. You know, you just feel like there's so much going on in the world and there's so many great podcasts. So I find if I'm not motivated, it's like a treat to put on a podcast and go for a long run. That gets me out the door.
We have a podcast that you might want to put on. I'm just saying. Stop by.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So these are our signature questions. We ask all of our guests, what is your earliest memory surrounding money and what does money mean to you?
Yeah, well, you talk about it in the book. My dad just screamed, Mark, get out of the car. Look at this. The downfall of America. And it was like the price of gas. And my mom is just like cringing in the front seat. You know, this was during the gas crisis. Like, I remember when it was 40 cents a gallon or 6 cents. I can't. Yeah. And it was like, what the heck? He's staring at a gas pump, screaming his head off. I was very young at the time. That was one. And then this other one where we were at Disney World at the Polynesian buffet, and my poor young sister, all she would eat is black olives. And he's like, $8 for this buffet, and all you're going to eat is black olives. I hope you choke on them. I'm like, look at me, Dad. I'm filling my plate. I'm eating. And every time there's a plate of food in front of me, I got to finish it.
Well, we could tell you were a product of the 70s. When you see the logo of your book, these little distribution curves, it's a little trippy. We put a black light under that. Mark, we appreciate it. You're a big get for us. We thank you for doing this all the way from Zurich, Switzerland, to have a guest on Stopping By. It's a big deal. So we appreciate you being generous with your time, and we hope to see you again. And thanks for stopping by.
Thanks. It's been a delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you both. It's been fun.
Thank you. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.